Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc forum called Prosecution Latches. No good deed goes unpunished. Speaking with us today, we're very pleased to have Joseph Mattel, the Honorable Paul Michel, and Jean Quinn. Moderating the discussion, we have Jeffrey Depp. Jeff is a patent attorney and the president of the Association for American Innovation. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. And with that, Jeff, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thanks, Edie. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining. I want to also extend a welcome and another thanks to our august panelists. We're thrilled to have them and going to bring a lot of insight and experience and hopefully some spirited back and forth as we talk about this controversial yet important and relevant current issue. I'm going to take a brief second here to introduce everybody. Most of the folks here really don't need much of an introduction, so we'll keep it brief. But starting with the Honorable Paul Michel, former, as everyone should know, former chief judge on the Federal Circuit, who retired in 2010 because he felt he could be more effective, as I've heard him say, helping to advocate and improve improving the patent system, which we all know is crucial to moving forward the nation. And he is a prolific speaker and commentator on issues of the day, and speaks frequently at Federalist Society and other events. And we're thrilled to have him and his insight from his experience on the bench with this issue. Next, we have Jean Quinn, also needs very little introduction, but Jean is the president and CEO of IP Watchdog. He is a patent attorney, leading commentator on patent law and innovation policy. He's been twice named one of the top most 50 most influential people in intellectual property. And again, as I mentioned, IP Watchdog is the must-read site daily for anyone interested in intellectual property. And Gene has built that site since he founded it in 1999, too. Again, this is the place to go for IP news of the day and commentary. And again, and his experience as a practitioner is going to be invaluable in this discussion as well. So thank you, Gene, for joining us. And last but not least, Joe Mattel is here. He's the principal at Clear IP. Joe spent many years at the patent office in solicitor roles, so he has a great experience with this issue and a lot of the inner workings of the patent office on major cases and important issues. And before he did that, he was working with the Senate Judiciary Committee. And in that capacity, he was involved in a number of important legislative actions regarding the patent system, including the American Invents Act. So again, Joe's insight, experience, and point of view is going to be invaluable in this discussion. And again, thank you so much, Joe, for being willing to be here. So with that, we're going to move right into the discussion. As Edie mentioned, we're talking about latches. And just as a brief setup, I thought, how can I best set this up and put the panel in a position to really run with the topic? So I said, well, let me pull up my handy dandy Black's Law Dictionary app and just say what it says about what is latches. And so just reading from it, it is an unreasonable delay in pursuing a right or claim, almost always an equitable one, in a way that prejudices the party against whom relief is sought. And it goes on to talk about it being an equitable doctrine by which a court denies relief to a claimant who has unreasonably delayed in asserting the claim when that delay has prejudiced the party against whom relief is sought. And there's a quote from a treaty on equity. The doctrine of latches is an instance of the exercise of the reserved power of equity to withhold relief otherwise regularly given, where in the particular case, the granting of such relief would be unfair or unjust. So that's a high level definition of laches. Gene, I'm going to start with you. Make that make sense in the IP setting. How is the laches applied? How does it work? What do we see with it in intellectual property matters?
So I almost don't know what to say to that question, because I think that this is not controversial and it's very easy. There's no such thing as prosecution laches. Now, I realize that there are some district courts that would disagree with that statement. And some on the federal circuit would disagree with that statement. But this is really a black and white issue. The Supreme Court has said twice now in the intellectual property context that there is no laches. Both times they were in the litigation context, one first with the copyright case, and then 3 years later with a patent case in the SCA hygiene case. But if we focus on just what the Supreme Court has said, what they said is that if there is a statute, then laches is not the proper, it just doesn't exist. It's not proper because laches is a gap filler. It's an equitable doctrine. And you look to equity where there is no law on the books. And here with prosecution, there is law. It is impossible. It is a factual and legal impossibility for an applicant to delay prosecution. Now, once upon a time, that may not have been the case, but ever since the U.S. changed to 20 years from the earliest filing date, the patent applicant can't possibly delay. You're given 6 months of a statute to respond to the office. And if you would go beyond that, then it goes abandoned. I mean, so I really don't see this as a questionable issue. I think once the Supreme Court gets this again, either the Federal Circuit sets themselves straight or the Supreme Court is going to overrule the Federal Circuit yet again.
So okay. Thanks, Gene. That's great. So you jumped right into prosecution laches. So, Judge, I'm going to turn to you now, because we often hear about, you know, this sort of breaking it down into sort of two components, if you will, like litigation laches and prosecution laches. You know, to Gene's point, are those two different things? Are they real? Talk a little bit about that for us.
Well, the doctrine is an invention of equity. And of course, half a century ago or longer, the U.S. eliminated the distinction between law courts and equity courts and law doctrines and equity doctrines. So the continued use of equitable means of preventing enforcement of a patent is on somewhat shaky ground just for that reason. And secondly, as Gene pointed out, where a statute clearly sets parameters, it's questionable whether a court should effectively overrule those parameters by saying, okay, well, you had a deadline for filing, and you met the deadline in the statute, but nevertheless, we're going to find your patent unenforceable, which is really the functional equivalent of invalid, even though you followed the statutory law and any regulations that tease out the details of implementing the statute. On the other hand, if it is reserved for what I'll call extreme cases, and I recognize that lawyers would differ about what case qualifies as extreme and what doesn't. But I can see justified use of prosecution laches or litigation laches in extreme cases. Now, of course, then we have a debate about, you know, what's extreme and how do you know and who decides? And that's troublesome to me because patent law is a part of commercial law. It involves commerce. buying and selling of properties of various types. And as a result, there's a huge premium on predictability. And latches in either setting is inherently unpredictable because it's a fact-specific doctrine, number one. And number two, it changes over time. So what would be a bar on enforcing a patent in one set of circumstances in one period might not be in a later one, or vice versa. So a lot of unpredictability is inherently in the mix. And the last thing I'd like to observe is that there is a tension between proper role of the legislature versus proper role of judges, because if the judge makes a judgment that something is effectively bad policy for purposes of a healthy innovation system, that starts to sound like the kind of judgment that's normally made, properly made, particularly in a democratic country, by the elected legislators, not unelected judges. And worse than that, there's a risk that the judges who are making up equity law in the context of this case and that case and the next one don't have a very full record before them, because they usually just have a narrow record based on two parties to a particular dispute. The Congress, by contrast, can have years and years of hearings, as preceded the passage of the AIA that Joe Mittal had such a strong hand in. And it can call in dozens, scores, hundreds, thousands potentially of experts and practitioners and economists and all sorts of other people who can shed light on the whole landscape and develop a factual record that could lead to a sound policy judgment. I'm not saying Congress is perfect, and we all have our opinions about Congress's wisdom or productivity and efficiency and so forth, but at least it's democratic as elected, and at least it has the better mechanisms, I would say, than courts to make these broad policy type judgments. So I'm skeptical of broad use of latches, but I'm not a proponent of saying let's outlaw latches forever in all circumstances. It's inherently meant to be for the extreme outlier case. And if it's used only in that way, it seems to me it's legitimate and the benefits outweigh the risks and problems. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Joe. So you kind of flagged maybe a separation of powers issue that I did kind of have on my list of things to talk about. So we'll try to come back to that. But Joe, I want to bring you in here, get your introductory thoughts on, you know, the role, the applicability of latches in an intellectual property context. And then, you know, again, just feel free to respond to, you know, what you've heard from Judge or about the unpredictability of it, or Gene, is it really a dead letter? You know, just, but again, this what do you think?
Sure. I guess I'd start off by agreeing with the judge that it is better to have a clear statutory deadline. And you, that way, you know, if you're in or you're out. The Supreme Court decided, because we have a statutory deadline on the reach back of damages, for example, there's no latches on, you know, for litigation. That deadline controls and decides how long people can delay. In the case of prosecution, though, there really isn't a deadline, and it's a classic case for where latches fills the gap to illustrate why latches exists. One of the recent cases where it's been applied is the Gil Hyatt litigation. Hyatt's been pursuing semiconductor patents for aspects of microprocessors that are under the pre-GATT system, meaning his term doesn't start to run until the patents would issue. And the bulk of his patents claim priority dates going back to the early 1970s, meaning he's been prosecuting these patents for over half a century now. Full disclosure, I was at the agency and was part of the team that made the decision about 5 or so years ago that it was finally time for the agency to assert latches against Hyatt. He'd done a number of things over the years to delay prosecution of his applications. When he'd get an allowance, he'd cancel the claims and start over again. And he has, you know, just unbelievably lengthy claims, and the applications have mushroomed into hundreds of applications. It's become a real nightmare for the agency just to process it. But the collective effect of his actions are why, you know, over 50 years later, we're still, you know, the agency, absent laches, would be forced to decide whether this guy is really entitled in this day and age to a patent on the microprocessor that, you know, can claim a priority date of 1971. Fortunately, the Federal Circuit, in its initial remand decision, and the district court on remand, agreed that, yes, this is a case where laches applies. As I've said in the past, if laches doesn't apply to Hyatt's conduct, it doesn't apply to anything. You're never going to get a case more extreme. In subsequent cases, lower courts have also applied it. It's been applied to the personalized media communications patents, which had been in prosecution since the early 1980s. And that application was upheld by the Federal Circuit. The issue that's being debated now at the Federal Circuit in the Google v. Sonos case is, well, now that we're no longer on a patent term that runs from issuance rather than filing, now that there's kind of a 20-year clock, you know, you can only delay for 20 years. Now, did that implicitly repeal laches when Congress enacted the Uruguay Round Agreements Act in 1995? Did that have the effect of displacing laches and repealing it? This is an issue the Federal Circuit's going to have to decide in Sonos v. Google, but the patent owner's principal argument is the only prejudice that can result from a delay of prosecution is extension of the patent term. And since you can no longer extend your term, then, you know, there can't possibly be any laches regardless, you know, what Sonos did. Sonos is a case where there was about a 13-year delay in asserting broadened claims. I think there were 11 generations of cons leading up to the current claims, meaning a chain of 11 applications getting to where they are now. And the district court also found that Sonos modified its specification in a way that was, shall we say, problematic and prejudicial. The whole case is about these zone scenes for music devices. It's sort of like a playlist that plays in different rooms. And you know, Google later came up with these zone scenes where you can have overlapping rooms that have the same playlist for them. I'm not totally sure why this invention is patent eligible, by the way. These kinds of indexes of music or content are usually not, but, you know, setting that aside, you know, the original specification described these zone scenes in a context where they're not permanent. They get, you know, broken up every time you change something. They shifted that language in their specification to another area where they're talking about permanent zone scenes to support this, these claims to, you know, again, like these overlapping zones where music plays for these permanent playlists that aren't, you know, erased every time you change something.
Yeah.
And the judge called foul on that and said, look, you doctored your specification to create written description support for this. You know, that's unreasonable behavior. You unreasonably delayed. And, you know, Judge Alsup applied laches in the case. So that's the first of that case.
Yeah. No, we're going to get to, definitely want to talk about both of these cases, the Sonos v. Google and the Hyatt case. But I want to just, you know, just continue with the background a little bit. You know, we've talked about laches, and it often, you know, it sort of comes up like left hand, right hand, where you're talking about prosecution laches in the context of continuation practice. So I just want to just touch on that a little bit. You know, Gene, talk a little bit about that connection. Why are those two things often discussed in the same breath? And what is the importance of continuation practice, you know, broadly in terms of the patent practice and working with innovators?
So I would just want to plant a flag, because there's some things that were said that were just false, and I hope we get a chance to come back to that. It will shock every patent practitioner and every patent applicant to hear that there is no deadline within which to take action, because there are statutory and they're rule based, and they lead to abandonment when you don't follow the rules and hefty penalties and fines and all the like. But with respect to continuation practice, this has been a part of the U.S. experience ever since I've been a member of the bar, and much longer than that, really. And there's a variety of different reasons why it exists. There's practical, and then there's legal. Legal, it's allowed, and not only is it allowed, the Patent Office is currently under a continuing injunction. They cannot do anything to limit the number of continuations. They're forbidden from doing that. So I know that some people have raised the argument that there is a limitation to the number of continuations, or that the statute was never envisioned as allowing any number of continuations to be filed. That's just not true. I mean, right now the Patent Office cannot do anything. It's up to Congress if they want to do something. You can file continuations during the life of your patent, and there's a variety of reasons why that makes sense. The first and most practical reason is while you're working with an examiner on an invention, the examiner is usually very hesitant to give you any claims, and you have to convince them that you're entitled to the claims. And then as the examiner becomes more familiar with your invention, your claims, and the prior art, it happens in every case where in subsequent patents, you get broader and broader and broader protection that you couldn't convince the examiner to give you the first time that they looked at it. And number two, as you're going through this, it should shock nobody to understand that most inventors are inventing down a path. You know, you very few people are Thomas Edison's of the world, or Elon Musk, or whoever you want to name, that can invent in a whole array of areas. You invent in an area and you build on your own work or the work of your colleagues. So sometimes you're improving things you've already done. And the only practical way to be able to file that patent application is by filing a continuation in part. And it pushes the envelope moving forward. Now, you always have the problem when you're filing continuation in part, it changes the priority date. It doesn't change the term. The term is going to end as of the same date as our first patent, but more will be prior art for you. And you have to think about that, whether that makes sense to do. But it is a way that you can expand your own portfolio, and it would be an enormous change of cataclysmic proportions. It has been said here, in the Hyatt case, he wanted hundreds of patents and with hundreds of claims. Well, is the problem that Gill is an individual, because the biggest companies in the world have tens of thousands of patents and hundreds of thousands of claims, you know, and how do you get that? You get that by a continuation strategy. So this is not a Gill Hyatt issue. This is a system issue. And if continuations were to go undone, and if laches now, as it stands right now with prosecution laches, the Federal Circuit says, if it takes you longer than 6 years, it's presumed the patent is unenforceable, which is exactly the opposite of what the statute says. But there will be millions of patents that need to get thrown away. Because I ask all the time in the programs that we do, how many of you in the audience, patent attorneys, patent agents, have cases that are more than 6 years old? Everybody raises their hand. And then I ask, how many of you have at least half of your docket that has been in process for more than 6 years? And 80 to 90% of people will raise their hand. This is a normal part of practice. We want to talk about settled expectations. This is a settled expectation, is the ability to do this. And if you take it away, it is going to dramatically and negatively affect rights and investment.
Thanks, Gene. That's great. So Judge, to you, you're with your policy hat on, you know, who, you know, I've heard you speak eloquently about the, you know, the importance of the strong patent rights to the innovation ecosystem. So, build on Gene's point here. Who is using these continuation practices? You know, what type of industries or sectors are using it? And just talk a little bit about that for us.
Well, no industry or technology is barred from using continuations. It's a generally available mechanism in the patent law and in the regulations and in the practice of prosecuting attorneys and operation of the patent office. There's a lot of public attention on the drug industry because of the high cost of many branded drugs until the patents expire. And there's a huge amount of political activity around that issue of high drug prices. And so the drug research-based drug companies that live by patents as well as by their innovations are very dependent on being able to use this practice as they find different embodiments and improvements on the original invention. Typically in the drug area, the first invention is a molecule itself, and then later inventions in the chain will involve things like method of delivery, method of manufacture, and other aspects of it. And even at a more detailed level, for example, sometimes a useful drug that addresses some serious disease requires infusion that means the patient has to go to a medical facility and sit there for 4 hours or so with a line in their arm. Further improvements are sometimes made so that instead of the infusion, it's an injection, or maybe instead of an injection, it's a pill. And then you have the situation where the pill has to be taken four times a day, let's say, in order to maintain effectiveness in the body of the afflicted person. And somebody does more research and is able to create a pill for the same purpose and using the same molecule that you only have to take once a day, or maybe once a week or once a month. Sure. So those are important improvements from the patient's standpoint, and that shows some of the value of continuation practice in that particular industry. I don't make the argument, however, that there are never to be any limits. When Joe Mattel stressed 11 continuation applications in the example he discussed, I don't imagine he was implying that 11 is a limit. If you have 12, it automatically latches. And I certainly wouldn't agree that it would be wise to have some arbitrary number of permitted continuations. On the other hand, it seems to me from 22 years on the Federal Circuit that there were quite a few examples in many different areas, including patent prosecution, of practices that look questionable, some that looked extreme, some that even would qualify for the label abusive. So again, I come back to the idea that the equitable doctrine of latches to make a patent unenforceable, functionally invalid, has a place for extreme cases that are abusive in the sense that nobody could have protected themselves as a practical matter from being sued after they maybe had invested a huge amount of time and money in developing a product and a factory and manufacturing. And then very late in the day, somebody gets a new claim on an old patent and catches them by surprise, sort of like getting hit from behind in the colloquial manner. So I think, regardless of industry, whether it's drugs or other industries, I think there is a place for prosecution-based latches when somebody files an infringement lawsuit. But the question is, should it be a wide open practice that's frequently applied, or should it be reserved for extreme cases that involve serious injustice, as best we can define that elusive word and concept? To me, it goes back to the central challenge in all patent doctrines, which is they have to balance competing considerations. We want to spark innovation to a high degree. We want to encourage investment, research effort, commercialization effort, risk-taking, improvements of products and all that. Yes, very important. But on the other hand, we want to have some level of fairness and predictability in the system. And sometimes those goals are in conflict. So then you have to have some way of sort of balancing these conflicting goals. And in, to my way of thinking, prosecution latches is such a tool. It's an attempt to balance otherwise impossible to balance conflicting goals. And I think it's useful for that purpose and tolerable for that purpose unless it becomes the norm.
Great, thank you. No, I think you've perfectly encapsulated the long title that we had for this event was is Latches, is it preventing abuse of the patent system or is it innovation killing judicial activism? And that's we're walking that line here. So let's take that little as a segue to get back into a specific discussion of how it's being applied currently. And again, as has been mentioned so far, we're going to try to focus on at least two cases, Google v. Sonos, Sonos v. Google, and then the Hyatt case. So we're going to start with Sonos v. Google. Now, I'll just give a quick refresher for folks who may not have been up on the latest and greatest, but that case is basically the briefing is done before the Federal Circuit. It's on appeal to the Federal Circuit, and we're just waiting for the oral argument to be scheduled. But, you know, in that case, the district court threw out a $33 million jury verdict that found finding two Sonos multi-zone smart speaker patents unenforceable due to prosecution latches. Sonos had amended its claims after learning of Google's particular product, and Judge Alsup found that approach inequitable, concluding that the patentee was, quote, wringing fresh claims to read on a competitor's product from an ancient application. Again, that case is now being appealed to the Federal Circuit. So, Gene.
Yeah.
You know what? let's get into this here.
So one, it's not an ancient application. Number two, any patent term that they would have gotten was limited based on the 20-year term maximum. And in that case, the patent that they got was only going to get something like 6 years of term. Number three, if you do that, you're going to and prevent people from adding claims, you're going to kill all kinds of industries, because that's what happened. That's just fundamentally what happens. And the reason for that is oftentimes with these most valuable applications, you invent this much and then you claim a subset of it. And, you know, and then once you figure out what is valuable, it's not like you're ambushing anybody. It's all there in black and white in your specification. And you're going and getting claims over here, claims over here, claims over here. And particularly in the pharmaceutical area where it takes 12, 14 years often to get through the FDA, you have no idea out of all the stuff that you've invented what the FDA is even going to allow. And once you have an idea of what the FDA is going to allow, if you fairly invented that and you disclosed it in your description, well, now go and claim it, right? It's yours, right? That's what is yours is based on what you filed. And then the office gets around to handing out and giving you the claims that you deserve. On their timetable. It's not on your timetable. It's on their timetable. And in the Sonos case, the big thing to point out in the Sonos case, latches is just absolutely the wrong legal theory. There is a legal theory here, and it can't possibly be latches because in those patents, those are governed by the 20-year term. There's no way. You either respond in the time given to you under the statute and what the office demands, or the case is going to go abandoned. I mean, that's just the way it is. And the argument here is one about disclosure. Did those claims that the patent office give you, were they supported by the original disclosure? And if yes, then they're yours. If no, they're not yours. You don't need to go. So I was explaining this to somebody the other day. Is like, and you, some of you may have heard this, that, you know, like if you're going to go to a horse park, you know, to a horse farm or to a rodeo, right? What are you going to see? You're going to see horses. If you see something off in the distance and you say, oh, that's a zebra. Okay. What are the odds that at a rodeo, you're going to see a zebra? What are the odds that at an equestrian park, you're going to see a zebra? Zero. right? Zero, none. So what you, a lot of people though do is they go and they look for the exotic, right? And they see the exotic everywhere. So what you see is zebras wherever you look, not because they're actually there, it's because you're looking for something exotic. Or in some cases, you're looking for something easy that lets it get out of the way. Oh, you just took too long. I don't have to do the heavy work of seeing whether your specification supported it and whether the claims are good. So we'll just get rid of this, maybe often in our cases in the patent world, on a motion to dismiss. Okay, so what every judge knows laches. It's second year remedies in law school, and if it's laches, it goes away. But this is not the right tool. If they did something nefarious, and or what it could be nefarious, or this happens all the time too, as everybody here knows. And it's not nefarious. It's an argument. I think the claims are covered based on what I initially filed. And sometimes the courts disagree. And sometimes the patent owner's right. And sometimes the courts are right. You know, it's a question about disclosure, not about laches.
Great. Okay. So Sonos is all right. Joe, we're going to come to you now. So Sonos basically, you know, and you summarized it, Gene. Sonos basically made two arguments. Is, hey, laches isn't available here. We don't even need to be talking about this because we didn't extend the term of our patent. It was all back to 20 years from the priority date. Nothing is getting extended. And then secondly, they said, okay, let's assume that that doesn't hold. Still, the elements of laches are not here, right? There's no unreasonable delay. And Google was not prejudiced here. So you covered that. So Joe, to you, you wrote a brief supporting, on behalf of the Retailers Association, supporting Google in this case. So, you know, your thoughts on Google's or Sonos's arguments here about the availability of laches and whether or not the elements are present.
Okay. Well, I mean, first and foremost, it's unquestionable that there is no time limit for seeking your last continuation. You can seek continuations up through the 20-year term. I've talked to people who have had a con issued against them that only had 4 months left of patent term. Someone got it in that 19. You can get it right up until the very end. It's a classic textbook case where laches applies. And the reason people don't, you know, the reason people aren't prejudiced by this is, you know, those claims that you're suddenly, discovering in your specification 10 years after the fact, the overwhelming pattern is people tend to draft those claims based not on what anything they actually disclosed earlier on or with no more than a tenuous relationship to that. They draft claims based on their competitors' products. And often in light of litigation and claim construction, and you try to capture those subtle differences in a brand new claim, you basically use the con is a do-over for your last litigation. And, the question is that okay? To some extent, like these questions have already been, you not only have Federal Circuit decisions affirming laches still applies, but the Supreme Court's weighed in on this issue at least half a dozen times. There are a series of decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court applying laches to prosecution tactics and saying this was an unreasonable amount of delay. Now, in this particular case, you know, this case is kind of unique in particular because of the way that Sonos modified its specification. That's unusual behavior, to say the least. People usually don't modify their spec to try to create support for new claims. But, aside from that fact, Sonos's principal argument is, well, laches can't apply because we didn't extend our term. So if there's no term extension, there can't be any prejudice. The problem with that argument, in my view, is if you look at the Supreme Court cases applying laches to prosecution conduct, the first like five or six of them all involved reissues. The Supreme Court found that a tardy reissue that broadened claims unfairly prejudiced the public and was barred for laches. As we all know, a reissue by definition cannot extend the patent term. So, by definition, the types of prejudice that the Supreme Court has told us is adequate to support laches in this context is not limited to things that extend your patent term. It was only in later cases in the early 20th century that the Supreme Court, relying on those reissue precedents, applied the same principle to continuations and said that a continuation if it's, again, unreasonably delayed and prejudicial to the public, can result in an application of laches. Now, you may be wondering why you never hear about reissue laches anymore. That's because in the 1952 Act, the application of laches in this area was so routine and so standard that the Congress codified it in what's now Section 251D, the bar on seeking a broadening reissue more than 2 years after the patent issues. And again, like once you have a deadline like that in the statute, then there's no longer any room to apply laches. But
doesn't that make the cases you rely on completely and totally irrelevant? Because they've been legislated.
The Supreme Court has made clear that laches can apply even if there's not an extension of patent.
Yeah, 100 years ago.
Those cases are still on the books. They define how the doctrine operates in the absence of a statute. And in the case of cons, there is no statutory deadline on seeking a con. You can seek a con in the last year.
I know you keep saying that, but there is. I mean, you can't, 30 years from now, I can't file a con.
Can you seek a con in the 19th year of your post-GATT patent term? Yes or no?
Yes, you can. And you can also, up until 6 months after the patent expires, you can try and take it away. So, I mean, you know, none of this is equal. It's always against the patent owner. You can file an IPR literally up until 6 years after the patent expired. You can file an IPR. You know, so, you know, it's just not fair. I mean,
well, can you assert the patent 6 months after it expires?
Yeah, you can assert it all the time. It happens.
I rest my case then. You know,
case, but why is that? I mean, these are the rules, Joe. These are just the way the rules are written.
Yeah, and part of those rules is the common law doctrine of laches, which was designed to protect the public against dilatory action, unreasonable action that prejudices the public. And we have half a dozen, I think 8 Supreme Court cases on point.
Yeah, but the last one that they talked about laches was from 2017. You don't have to go back 100 years like you're going back. You go back to 2017 and they said if there's a statute, it's not proper. And there is a statute. See, that's why you keep saying that there's no time limit. There is a time limit, and the time limit is actually in the statute.
There is a time limit on seeking broadening reissue. There's no time limit on filing a con. As long as the 20-year term hasn't expired, you can seek continuations up through the variant.
And the Federal Circuit has ruled that's
fine. It's a textbook case of where laches applies.
Boy, that's not true.
The Federal Circuit will resolve this in the Sonos v. Google case, but. The default rule is if there's no time limit on seeking a particular action and you unreasonably delay and prejudice the public, laches can apply.
And that also came up in the Hyatt case. Judge Hughes asked that question specifically, you know, is it to the patent office, you know, is the 6 year on the litigation side, the specific time frame, you know, is that the same as, you know, the deadline that's based on some event rather than a specific set of years, right? You know, that's really, he nailed it. That's the issue that we're trying to resolve. Why can't you extend that into an event-based deadline versus a fixed time period? And frankly, the patent office didn't have much of an answer for that because it implied that it was.
Well, they don't have an answer for Hyatt because they put Hyatt into SAWS for over a generation, where that meant that he was not getting considered. He was not, people in the SAWS program weren't even told they were in the SAWS program. It's just there was an absolute prohibition against issuing any patents and any applications that were in SAWS. And Gill it's the record in these cases. He was in SAWS, and only over the last several years has his applications gotten out of that. And now they're going and they're appealing them. And now after putting him on ice for a generation in SAWS, now they're saying, oh, you waited too long to prosecute. If Gill did something wrong, then the patent office clearly did something wrong. Because Gill was operating within the rules. The SAWS program was completely and totally outside of any boundaries of the rules. And it's hard to believe that the United States government was involved in it. But they were. We know. They've admitted it.
You know, Jeff,
well, I just urge you to look up the district court decision in the Hyatt case. He describes the exact conduct that Hyatt engaged in. He had cases where claims were allowed and he still went back and rewrote them. It was a clear conduct of dilatory behavior. And look, but no matter what like anyone examiner might have done
that,
wrong.
Is there anything wrong case, with that?
Like there's no one that. Action that otherwise could have resulted in a 50-year delay of hundreds of applications without some involvement by the patent applicant and engineering that kind of delay. It's just impossible for a conspiracy that vast to be exercised by the office to delay.
So are you denying SAWS? Are you denying that it happened? I mean, it happened to thousands of applications.
SAWS is not the reason why Hyatt's 400 applications have been pending for over half a century.
Judge, let me bring you in here. But yeah, in that same oral argument, Joe, Judge Hughes also said to the patent office that Mr. Hyatt has done nothing wrong here. He followed the law. So, I mean, the Federal Circuit is, you know, at least in the oral argument, is on record, you know, that there isn't a problem with what he did. But Judge, to your point, or to this discussion, yeah, help us understand from your point of view, you know, help us resolve the question that Judge Hughes asked. Is 6 years a hard fixed term and a event-driven deadline, are those the same? Are those sufficiently sort of statutory such that laches would not be relevant because the statute addresses it? Because that's the question that the Federal Circuit is grappling with right now.
Well, let me just back up a second to observe that many of the suggestions that have been made today and before today by various spokesmen use very broad terms. Waited too long, with no definition of what too long is, or targeted some particular product of a competitor as if there's something inherently wrong with monitoring what competitors are doing and seeing if your patent covers their product. So the problem I have with a lot of the debate is that it's at way too overheated and emotional a tone and at way too over aggregated a set of factors. It's just not helpful to talk about waited too long or filed too many. It just doesn't make any sense to say, okay, you can file 12, but the 13th is automatically bad, is going to be the subject of laches. The same thing with a time delay with the number of continuations or with targeting. None of those, to my way of thinking, are appropriate considerations for deciding whether to invoke the rare remedy of laches to prevent somebody from enforcing a patent. And to try to create hard and fast rules, like a presumption that 6 years is all you get, to me, number one, it's inconsistent with the whole notion of laches, which is it's an inherently very flexible doctrine. It's not supposed to be limited to hard numbers of any kind, not six continuations, not 6 years, et cetera. A lurking problem in the background also is the suspicion that some people have that the quality of the examination is not rigorous enough. So Gene says, and it's very logical and it fits the law, if the specification filed way back when covers the new claim that in continuation number 12 or whatever applicant is seeking, there's a concern that the examination is just not rigorous enough. And that's a real concern. And it may very well have a factual basis. I don't have any studies or statistics to prove that. But my observation as an outsider to prosecution practice, but seeing a lot of patent cases for the last 35 years, is that most examiners do a rather poor job when analyzing the considerations under Section 112 about adequate disclosure, adequate written description, and truly enabling disclosures that allow anybody else to practice the invention successfully without undue experimentation. But you can't have judges guessing about the quality of examination and saying, well, in my opinion, as Judge A, it stinks, and therefore I'm going to use prosecution latches all over the place. And then Judge B says, oh, no, it's very good, and it's almost always correct, so I'm going to never use latches because I'm trusting the examiner. And to me, neither of those extreme positions makes any sense. So we come back to, can we define unreasonable delay in our court system in a way to give predictive guidance to all the players on both sides of the case? And can we make it inherently fair as opposed to totally subjective of this judge or that judge? And that's my concern about the misuse or the overly broad use of latches. It just becomes, you know, in that case, that judge is the king. He can sort of do whatever he wants, whether it's consistent with what other judges have done or not. Then, of course, you never get total consistency, total identical treatment of supposedly identical or comparable facts. But it's a good goal to aim at, and you should get close. And if you're not getting close, then there's something seriously wrong with the system. So I'm hoping that the Federal Circuit will be precise and careful and not adopt some broad rule in either direction that would make latches routinely available or virtually never available, because that's, to me, wars with the whole history of latches, not only in American jurisprudence, but for five centuries earlier in British equity jurisprudence. It's supposed to be for the case that's really extreme, the far out outlier where somebody really got hurt. And if it's kept to that, I think it's defensible.
So would you support then? It sounds like you wouldn't, but don't let me put words in your mouth. Sort of extending SCA beyond, you know, the 6-year statute of limitation for filing a lawsuit into prosecution, as long as you're following the statute, and therefore latches would no longer be available?
I don't see why using a hard and fast number for anything fits the notion of equity. Whether it's number of applications, what year of the in the 20-year timeline it was filed, or using six from an analogous statutory provision, I'm against hard and fast rules, even though I'm in favor of trying to have some acceptable functioning level of predictability. So you can't have it totally wide open and subjective, but you can't have it rigid either, because rigidity is inconsistent with equity.
So you don't even like SCA hygiene then, even that rule.
Well, you know,
for bringing suits.
The rule is what it is. I mean, I believe in precedent because I was part of the system where precedent governs, whether you agree with it or not. So
fair enough.
I'm not happy with it, but it's clearly,
I got you. That's what it sounded like. Again, it's consistent with your flexibility approach. So, okay. So moving to, in the few minutes we have left, let's jump ahead and let's talk about the implications of this to the innovation ecosystem. Let's say that the court affirms the district court here, the Federal Circuit affirms the district court, and continuation practice is thrown into tumult. It becomes unreliable and concerning and a problem for, you know, as we talked earlier, it's a common practice. Everybody's using it, whether you're an early stage inventor at a university or you're in a corporate setting and you're taking advantage of continuation practice. You rely on it. It's an important part of the process. So if that goes or becomes much less, again, reliable, let's say, what happens to the innovation ecosystem? You know, I think somebody mentioned there's a number of, Gene, you were talking about how you ask people all the time about how many patents would be potentially unenforceable because they're going on. You know, I've heard statistics that 40% of all pharma patents could just immediately become, unenforceable. What's that going to do to our ongoing, battle in the country to maintain our leadership position, to catch up or overtake China, depending upon your perspectives, grow the economy, create high paying jobs, bring manufacturing back? Get out your crystal ball and let us know what you think.
Well, I think it's going to be catastrophic. I don't think we have to worry about them doing away with continuation. That's the net effect, but it's not going to be like you can't file a continuation. This 6 years is extraordinarily troublesome, and the reason why it will be catastrophic because of the backlog at the office. The backlog at the office is practically an all-time high, maybe is an all-time high. There's 1.2 plus million applications pending, and almost 900,000 of which have not even ever been picked up by an examiner. And we have at the moment, for a variety of reasons, you know, we don't need to get into it here, but there just descriptively is a hiring freeze. There are people who expect over the next month there will be a workforce reduction at the patent office. I don't think many of us think it'll be examiners. I do think many of us think that at some point before the end of the year, they'll start hiring examiners again. But there is at least a 3 to 4 year backlog before you're going to get anything, no matter how easy or how trivial, outside the patent office with these numbers. And in a lot of the areas where we're talking about with the life sciences, you're talking about artificial intelligence, you're talking about the critical and emerging technologies, the most valuable things, those always historically take much longer. And particularly the new inventions, because it takes the examiner's time to come up to speed, become familiar with things, et cetera. You will have functionally a 0% chance of getting a single continuation through, because these things are not filed willy-nilly at the beginning. You file an application and get a representative set of claims, and then as the examiner becomes more familiar, you become more familiar with the prior art the examiner uses. Towards the end of that first prosecution is when you start filing continuations to go after different silos within the disclosure. There won't be any time left. It will take every bit of 6 years in these critical and emerging fields to get the first answer. You may not even be able to. Historically, if you go back with artificial intelligence and software generally, which I know best, when these new technologies come up, it can take 8-10 years to get your first patent. Okay, so, and that means a whole host of these areas, you will have zero patent protection. There'll be no reason to go for patent protection, putting us at a competitive disadvantage. And whether people like it or not, investors always, even Mark Cuban, who says he doesn't like patents, if you watch Shark Tank, always asks, do you have a patent? Okay, and there is about, being honest, at least 2/3 of investors, there's 1/3 that probably don't care. They're concerned with size of market and time to market, get to market and build that way. But at least 2/3 of the people that are investing won't care about patents. Why would you knowingly cut yourself out of 2/3 of a market that is already a small market, much smaller than it should be? Patents matter. And we're at the precipice of doing something enormously reckless.
And Jeff,
right, Joe, to you. Oh yeah, go ahead, Judge.
No, let Joe go first.
Joe, if continuation practice is turned on its head, is it going to be catastrophic for the innovation ecosystem?
Yeah, I can understand Gene's concern about the backlog, but that's not a Latches problem. Latches looks at delay by the applicant. Delay by the office wouldn't weigh against you. It's unreasonable conduct that you engaged in. As to the particular implications of the Sonos v. Google case, again, like if the district court is affirmed, I suspect the fact that they modified their written description support to, create support for these claims will be a major factor, which kind of limits the precedent. That just doesn't happen that often. I would point out, though, that the Supreme Court cases that first applied laches to the prosecution context, look to the fact that claims were broadened. So you didn't have to have invalid claims for laches to apply, just the fact that late in the life of the application, claims were broadened to claim things that the court deemed otherwise dedicated to the public was the basis for applying laches. And again, I'd agree with Judge Michelle, we'd be better off with clear rules on how late you can file your cons or what you can do, et cetera, rather than this multi-factor laches test. But in the absence of clear rules, when you're allowed to, you know, file on your competitor's product up through year 19, this is a textbook case of where laches fills the gap.
Well, I hope that the Federal Circuit's opinion is as deftly written as Joe implies it might be, and I agree with him. It could be written fairly narrowly to do minimal harm. If it is written broadly and it upends continuation practice and makes it effectively unavailable and unused, it plainly will be catastrophic for our innovation ecosystem and for our attempt to compete with economic rivals in Europe and Asia and strategic rivals like China. So it all depends on how they do it. But, you know, when you come right down to it, if continuation practice is to be exploded, let Congress make that decision, not three judges on a Federal Circuit panel who don't have any background in the realities of what happens in the real world.
Excellent. Okay, so we are at the hour. We're going to run a little bit over just to give everybody a chance to offer some final remarks. And Gene, I'll start with you.
So I don't necessarily disagree with what Joe just said there at the end, except for I do think that the patent office delay is a problem in this whole equation with the backlog, and that's the fundamental problem with having it be a presumption that if it took you longer than 6 years, laches will be presumed. You know, if you want to have it, we could have a conversation about whether or not laches can be considered, you know, or should be considered and under what circumstances it should be considered. But the presumption of laches runs afoul, I think, of the statute that says patents are supposed to be presumed valid. It goes directly contrary to that. So it all depends. Is this going to be catastrophic? Is it going to be bad? Is it going to be a big nothing burger? All depends upon how the court writes the decision in Google versus Sonos and in the Hyatt case.
Yeah, you're concluding thoughts.
Can I just add that, I think it'd be, you know, the judge mentioned Congress setting rules. I think the agency also has authority to set basic rules on these types of matters. They can also set rules, frankly, requiring people to identify written description support for new limitations in their continuing applications. That would help deal with some of these 112 problems. And again, I just reiterate, though, you have, you know, 6 or 8 Supreme Court cases on point that emphasize that laches can apply when you broaden your claims to claim new things, new things that you hadn't claimed earlier in those out years. That's binding precedent that, you know, can't just, you know, that controls this case. It's the Supreme Court, you know, we have to listen to it. That's going to guide, I assume that'll guide the decision in this case.
Jeff, my big worry is that the potential explosion of continuation opportunities for patent applicants from the Federal Circuit decision in Sonos or other cases for that matter, it doesn't take place in a vacuum. And it's not only a question of how many examiners there are, or how good they are, or how big the backlog is at this or that time interval. The question is whether people in the commercial inventive world in all technologies will have enough faith in the patent system to want to seek patents and utilize patents as a way to spark innovation and commercialization of new inventions. We already have so many headwinds against the patent applicant or the patent owner with the mess of eligibility law, with the hugely extended notion of the eBay case against injunctions for most successful patent enforcers, the problems at the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. And when you look at that entire background that already is in place, if we add a highly fragmented continuation practice on top of all those other headwinds, we're going to lose every technology race against every country.
Agreed, Judge. Thank you. And I'll just for the audience consumption, just to maybe put an applied bow on this, you know, take a look at the New York Times today. There's an article about an innovation in the pharmaceutical industry where we're now, some studies have come out on the on oral GLP-1 agonist drugs. So, you know, because of the innovation, because in my view, because of the patent system, you know, it allowed Lilly to develop, you know, an oral drug for these injectables that are so popular. And, you know, that is a tremendous advance. It's going to make them, you know, again, it's a small molecule drug. So it's not on a peptide. So it should be significantly less expensive and, you know, more widely available. And again, this was a technology that was licensed from a Japanese company and then further developed by an American company and is going to represent a significant advance and ability to increase the availability, the lower the cost, make these drugs easier to take. Clearly, if it's an oral medicine versus an injectable, this is the kind of innovation that we're looking for. This is the kind of innovations that rely on patents, the strong patent rights, in order to make the investments necessary to license, further develop, and bring to market these types of advancements. So again, it's highly relevant. It just was in the paper today, and I thought I would mention it here as to buttress the point that you're making. So with that, we're 5 minutes over. I'm going to just throw it back to you, Edie, to close us out.
Yeah, thank you so much on behalf of the Federalist Society to you all, Joseph, Paul, and Jean for speaking, and Jeff for moderating. We really appreciate your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.